Hey guys, it's May 20th, 2018, and this is your episode 146 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and with me, as usual, are Laurel Black.
Hi.
And Megan Arns is out this episode, but she'll be joining us soon. I believe she's in Ghana with some students, so hopefully she's getting some good field recordings and will bring lots of cool information back for us. And Ben Charles is here. How's it going, Ben?
Hi, everybody. Doing well?
Ben, where are you at? You're not in your regular location.
I am not. I'm in Northern California near San Jose for the NorCal Music Festival. I got booked super last minute to play this. I was booked on Friday and left on Wednesday. That's how last minute it was. But yeah, it's been nice. Played some Beethoven and Mozart a couple nights ago and playing some Piazzolla tomorrow. So it's fun stuff.
Would you play in Beethoven? Did you play marimba? I bet it was
Yeah.
marimba.
Yeah, that famous Beethoven Marimba Excerpt and Egmont Overture.
Oh, that's right. And then the djembe.
Yeah, and then the djembe was
Right.
in Prometheus Overture, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I love that lick. The lick is so such a tasty beat. Yeah, good. Well, you guys, our guest today is an assistant professor of percussion at Southeastern University, where he teaches applied percussion, percussion techniques, music theory, world music, and he has created the first ever drumline at Southeastern University. So we definitely want to ask him about creating a drumline. He's a gifted composer and has performed as a soloist, chamber musician, orchestral player, and studio percussionist with groups such as the Carmel Symphony Orchestra, the Terry Hoyt, which you'll have to make sure I said that right, Symphony Orchestra, Columbus, Indiana Philharmonic, and he's part of the Blue Hill Percussion Duo with Colin Hill, who we have had on the podcast many episodes ago. So, Brian Bloom, how's it going?
Very good. Thank you, guys. Long time listener of the podcast, so it's really great to get to chat with you guys. Good to be here. Thank you.
How do I pronounce that Symphony Orchestra?
It's
Terry
Terre
Hoyt?
Haute,
Terre
actually.
Haute. Oh, okay.
Terre Haute. It's like out in western Indiana.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, since it was right there in your little introduction, I think why not dive in? Can you talk about starting this drumline at Southeastern University?
Sure. Yeah, so they started football here in 2013, and as part of that, they thought, hey, let's have a marching band. And it's a real small school. And fortunately, the folks, this was before I was here, the folks in the music area realized, yeah, probably not going to happen with a marching band, in a year's time, especially. But hey, we might be able to put together a drum line, which still captures a little bit of that college experience, And so they put a feeler out for somebody to come do that, as well as, do the percussion studio thing and kind of build that side up too. And it worked out for me to come do that. So the first year, they were kind of just practicing football, and we were just putting together, trying to recruit drumline students. And so I started with obviously what we had here, students that were here on campus already, and I was putting out all kinds of feelers and trying to get connected with, through the student life people and whoever I could. And we had a kind of an odd request from somebody who had a connection with the university or something, and she's recording some music video. I guess she's like, I don't know exactly what she does, but she does film work. She's an actress, musician. Can't explain the video, but it worked out for us in that she's like, hey, we need a drum line. I heard you guys have a drum line. It's like, well, we don't yet. I'd been here like 2 months. It's like, no, we don't have a drum line yet, but this might be a really cool opportunity for me to try to find some more people to come be in this music video. So she found some drums from like Busch Gardens and borrowed them because we didn't even have drums yet. And so that was like my first connection to find a bunch of people that were semi-interested or had some experience, had done drumline in high school and stuff. So that was really helpful, kind of getting some names. And then I asked them, hey, do you know more people, just playing that whole game. We had to, I got, put together the whole instrument list that we needed, instrument sticks, heads. We designed a custom uniform through DeMoulin, which was really cool. I had a lot of help from my dean with that, who had some connections in the marching world. And so, yeah, it was fortunately we had a good deal of support financially from the university to make this happen? Because, you know, I think maybe I told you, Casey, when you were here, I was like, anybody can start a drumline if you've got money. Sure. Anybody can do nearly anything if you've got enough money, you know. And thankfully, the university supported a lot in scholarship to help. Like, we can award nearly every student scholarship to be in the drumline. Some, it's several thousand dollars if they're really good, which is huge. Yeah, I know, because we don't have any other incentive. It's not, we don't have a stipend. There's no credit. It's not a class. But we do have scholarship, which is awesome. Yeah. And so that's how I rope pretty much everyone in. I mean, there's some kids that'll do it regardless, but there are a lot of kids where it's like, hey, if I can get you $2,000 a year, they're like, okay, now I'll think about it. Now you're talking.
Oh, yeah.
And then at some of those, that's how I get them over the hump to pay their, you know, tuition to maybe come be a percussion major too. And that works out really well for me. And I was just that whole first year of putting stuff together. Honestly, when I came here, when I took the job, I thought for sure it was going to be like me and three kids in the drumline. I was totally prepared to play in the drumline. Like, I just thought it was, because I did the Indianapolis Colts drumline for a year when I lived in Indy before I came here. It was total entertainment drumline, you know? Mm-hmm. And I kind of figured that's what we would do. I thought we'd wear like our, you know, khaki shorts and a Southeastern t-shirt and play drums. And my dean had other plans. And thankfully, you know, the university had an idea of like making this a college drumline. So that's kind of what we've tried to do. You know, it's a weird mix of like college drumline and entertainment drumline. I come from a, you know, DCI like background, so that's how I play and teach. But we also want to have fun. Like, I actually never did college drumline, which, you know, I could talk about later, having to do with Tony Cerrone and studying with him, and he didn't want me to do college drumline.
Yeah, I love that story. We definitely have to. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, it's been fun. We've had no fewer than 16 every year we've done it in our four years, and we'll probably have maybe 18 or 20 next year. Kind of hovered in that range each year, and definitely totally changed the culture at the university in a really good way. Like, we get requests all the time. I heard, you know, you guys have talked about like steel ensembles, steel bands. As soon as you get a steel band, you get requests to do stuff, and it's like that with my drumline too.
Yeah, what do you got, Laura?
It's really cool that the university had a vision and that they were very realistic that you mm-hmm. cannot create something like that without putting money towards it. And yeah, you can't make these demands on students. We've encountered administrators who they have to go give a speech and they're like, will the choir come and sing the alma mater before I speak? It's like, no, they have class.
Well, not only that, and this isn't JMU Laurel's talking about. This is somewhere else. But yeah, not only will they make that request, but they'll do it like the day of. Can't you just get that together? I mean, that's what you guys do, right? It's like, well, they're students. They have to plan. We have to like make excuse forms. We have anyway.
I require a 1 month like lead time, pretty much is what I tell everybody. If you want to book us, it's got to be at least a month, ideally like three or more. Because yeah, I've got 15 or 20 students. I can't just be like, hey guys, skip everything, drop your work, drop your class, and come do this thing.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. They're students. They're not entertainers. They're right. Students.
The funny thing though is they probably would if you asked them to.
Most of them would. Yeah.
Like, oh, I have to skip class. Oh, I guess I got to play. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a question sort of in the same vein. One thing that I've gotten a lot is, like, can the drumline come play from 5 to 7 tonight? Just like something right. Like people don't necessarily understand that, you know, drumlines generally have a limited repertoire of like a few cadences. And even if they mm-hmm. can loop them infinitely, it's after 2 hours. I mean, you're
it's
just going
to
be
hours.
Everyone, right. The players and
I've
the listeners
totally
are going to be dead.
You know.
And so that sort of thing, yeah. I think, is slightly easier because if you're given enough notice, you say, well, we can come do something, but I don't think that you know exactly what you're asking for. So have you ever right. had those situations to address, and how have you addressed those and explained
totally.
Diplomatically what's going on?
Yeah. Well, in almost every situation, when somebody's coming to me and asking, you know, it makes me feel like I've got the upper hand a little bit. So I can say, here's what we can and can't do. And nearly, I think probably every time that's happened, they just say, oh, okay, let this instead. Because they literally, you know, like you said, they just don't understand what it's not like jazz combo sit in the background and play and ask to play background music. We don't play background music, you know?
Soft buzz roll.
Yeah, that's soft. Like we've been asked that. Like I said, that's just not going to work. You're not going to hear anything that's going on. Trying to play that. So to be is clear about, you know, what it would actually be if we did what they asked us to do and how that wouldn't work, and then suggest a couple other options instead. And that usually goes over well.
So the marching band here at JMU last year was 430.
Wow.
So I know they get asked to do things a lot, but they're such a force to be reckoned with that it's they've got, I think they can pretty much do whatever they feel like doing, whatever not.
Totally.
Oh yeah. Well, and it's so funny, you know, they, like when they get on the field, there's so many of them. It's just kind of this blob that moves around.
Yeah.
There's not really much that happens.
That's a big deal there, man. That's so cool.
Well, it hurts Laurel's pride a little bit that JMU is bigger than UT, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not really. I mean, UT was fun before you were a section leader, and then you're like, wait.
You have to do lots of extra hard work.
Like, you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, though, Brian, you know, since you've started one of these, like, is there something that has surprised you, or what did you think would happen a certain way and totally went this other way that everybody else could learn from?
Well, one, I mentioned, surprised that I got 16 kids in a good way. And they weren't very good. It was total smoke and mirrors. Sorry, kids, if you're in that group, you put on a fancy uniform. We had nice looking drums and all that. So, and everybody loved it. And that was the second surprise, was how big it was here. Everybody just flipped about the drum line. You know, to your football team, who actually has been very successful in their, you know, their level. First year drumline a couple years ago and first year football, and people were like, yeah, I'd just rather watch the drumline than the football team. I'm like, what? I don't know, because it was obviously a very good surprise, but people just totally hyped more than I ever would have expected about the drumline. That's been really cool. Other than that, I mean, I think it's gone, you know, there's lots of little things that surprise you here and there, trying to keep kids in the drum line, or kids that surprise you at, oh, you know, you're a cello player, but you are also a really good tenor player. That's awesome. You know, things like that. But kids coming out of the woodwork in a small school here. I mean, I recruit tons of all the music majors of all instruments and voice and all that to come in the drum line. Tell them how much it's going to make them a player.
I love seeing that at Concord. Just, I'm a sax player, but I want to march cymbals, or, mm-hmm. I'm a vocalist, but I'm here to play tenors. You know, we would see that a lot. It was really fun. I was going to ask you, Brian, to repeat that story you told me when I was visiting, because you're a graduate of Indiana University, mm-hmm. and you're, I think it's safe to say this, you're one of kind of the last generation of Tony Cerone students, mm-hmm. before he retired, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, you've got this sweet story about kind of him coming to terms with like the DCI activity.
Yeah. So I was there when Cerone retired. His last 4 years were my 4 years of undergrad. And I loved studying with him. He took me kind of under his wing when I probably shouldn't have even been there, but, but the drum corps activity is actually really what helped me probably just barely weasel my way into Indiana at the audition, because I had just gotten into drum corps and just began kind of raising my level of awareness and understanding of detail in music and technical ability too. And I think it was just enough to get me in the door. And immediately from early lessons with Cerone, I sensed this tension regarding the marching thing, because that was a huge part of my upbringing. My dad was a band director. I was in marching band from sixth grade through 12th grade because I had to be, because there's just so few people. And so that, like I said, that was a huge part of my musical upbringing. And so, you know, I would see slashed notes and I'd play them as like diddles or rolls, you know, and Cerrone would just like make fun of me almost, you know, or just like, oh, come on, you marching people. And, right. And so I really sensed that maybe into my freshman year where I say, he's like, what are you doing this summer? And I said, well, I'm going back for another season of drum corps. And he's like, oh man, you really should be, you've already done that. You should be doing like a music camp or festival or something like that. And I said, well, that's, you know, it's kind of too late. I've already made my call on that. And he just didn't really see the value of it. And similar thing happens again the next year. And I said, this time I was like, when was the last time you've seen a drum corps show? And he's like, oh, I don't know. It's, you know, it's been a long time. But I said, well, you should probably go check it out. Like, you might be surprised at the like quality and what these kids are doing. And I also thought it was kind of funny because when you looked around the studio at Indiana that time, you know, 50, 60 percussion majors, most of the best players at that time had a marching background. And there were a few that were currently marching at that time. And so anyway, my parents offered, I don't know why, but they offered to buy Cerrone tickets to a drum corps show that summer in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. just to see if he would go and to say like, hey, you should come check it out. You can see a couple of your current students performing. And he took him up on it. He came to the show by himself in Indianapolis. It was 2005. And he was blown away. He came and saw me in the parking lot afterwards. And then we talked some more when I got back to school that fall. And he was just like, wow, they're like playing with four mallets and there's so many of them and like they're so good. And he just like couldn't believe it because he probably had not ever seen a pit like in marching, sure. you know, in drum corps. It'd probably been so many years. And he kind of was under the impression too that he would say things like, you know, oh, well, you marching guys, you just learn things by rote. But here, you know, here's the importance of reading. And it's like, no, we also read music. Like that's a big part of our learning process. And so that was the beginning of sort of a shift, I think, in his mindset and approach of with the whole marching activity. And then when he would bring it up in classes or lessons or something, it would be a much gentler approach to it, you know. Yeah. Well, you know, this marching such and such, but I realize you do this or something like that. And it was really cool. And just he had that humility to really explore and to say, yeah, okay, I'm interested. What are you guys doing? And learn more about it. And it really helped, I think, change his perspectives on it a little bit. That was cool.
Well, it's just such a huge, I don't know, it says so much about his character that,
yeah.
you know, maybe he wasn't interested in the activity at that point, but he was interested enough in you guys that he
yeah.
went to the show.
Yeah.
You and know? Like
some of the guys I marched with that year in particular, well, any of my years, I mean, they were literally students at Juilliard, at Manhattan School of Music, Cleveland Institute, you know, like these guys were all like percussion majors at these other quality music programs. And I told him that, and that kind of was like almost didn't compute at first, you know. It's like, oh, okay.
Right.
So he was interested, and yeah, it definitely said a lot about him and his care for his students and his desire to learn. That was really cool.
There must have been a time when there was a very hard line drawn.
I really got that sense. Yeah, I didn't grow up in that so much, but.
Right. Well, I don't know if any of us really did, but right. I definitely hear of it. But yeah, like you said, it's not uncommon at all that, yeah, someone at Juilliard was also in DCI or, you know, yeah, that's very common for us to hear. But
yeah,
you talk to certain people of that generation and that's like surprising, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One, two, just the how things have changed. You know, you're talking about that hard line between and. Like, I think now what it takes to get an orchestra job versus some mm-hmm. of the stories we've heard.
Like Cerrone's.
Yeah. Where it's like, oh, I just got a call and I went.
Yeah.
Like, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy. Right. Or yeah, you're just grandfathered in. You know, my teacher brought me, and then I did okay, and they invited me to stay, basically.
Right. Who was the one that I found that, like, that someone else played an audition, and the teacher said, like, if you think that guy's good, you should hear my other student, or something like that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I don't remember, but yeah, you had that.
Was it Alan Abel or John Beck? I can't remember someone, but yeah, there was a story of, like, someone took an orchestra audition because, like, the person that was supposed to audition, like, wasn't around, and the teacher's just like, yeah, if you think this guy's good, my other student's even better. And, like, they hired the other guy because this guy already had a job.
Right, the guy they didn't even hear, they hired. Yeah, that's
how I got my college teaching job, too. They just heard someone else play, and they were like, oh, well, this other guy's even better. Just kidding.
Yeah. Well, you guys, I'm going to give you a little sound today. Laurel's going to help me with it. So, hint is that this is considered by some to be a superfood. These hints are never helpful, are they? Nope. All right, any ideas?
Sounds like an aleatoric beatbox.
I literally thought you were, like, fumbling around with your recording trying to get the sound to play. That's why I said, like, edit this out.
it sounds like something about a superfood. It sounds like something like a really close a contact mic or something on some food and, like, fiddling with something like that. I don't know. It sounds really cool, though.
It's a cool sound. I really wish they would give more information in how they recorded this, what they did, or like what the setting was in the room. But this is actually the sound of rhubarb growing.
What?
Yeah. So if you know what rhubarb is, it's that. It's that. By the way, is rhubarb a fruit or a vegetable?
Vegetable?
You are right. Yeah, it's a vegetable. It sometimes gets confused for a fruit because I guess it can have a really tart and or sweet taste, depending on how it is grown and how long they let it ripen. And it's used in desserts a lot. So people, like, if you know the taste of it, supposedly, you might think it's a fruit. But if you know what it looks like, it's, like, clearly a vegetable. So, yeah, it basically looks like this pink or reddish celery, basically. So, yeah, this was sent to me by a buddy of ours, Maggie Mainland. And it's from a website called Atlas Obscura. I'm not sure if that's where it originated from or not, but it's literally the sound of the vegetable rhubarb growing. This particular method of growing is called forced rhubarb. This is from the website now. Forced rhubarb, which is made to mature in near total darkness, grows at such an alarming rate, as much as an inch a day, that it actually makes squeaks, creaks, and pops as it gets bigger. It makes for a sweeter rhubarb, growers say, and sick beets. Yeah?
That's a lot, an inch a day?
Yeah, I know. So I guess, like, it's all, they say it's all, like, interlaced and really compact together. So you can imagine, like, as it, you know, as they expand and get bigger, they kind of, like, pop out and squeak and rub up against each other, and you get these little sounds. Farmers allow the rhubarb to grow out in the open for 2 years and then transplant it to this warm and lightless environment. As the stalks burst up out of their initial buds, they create a distinct popping sound. As they get larger, the stalks rub together and create squeaks and creaks. It's growing over an inch a day. It's not like your field or garden where things grow 2 or 3 feet apart from each other. They're all very tightly wound and interweaved together, like I said. So yeah, some people call this a superfood because of its nutritional value in calcium, but it does not make the lists of many superfood lists, including one that Laurel and I found on Percussive Notes from former guest Andy Harnsberger. So, smoothest segue ever to that.
Yeah, good job.
Yeah.
So, Andy's article is called Top 10 Brain Boosting Foods. So, this isn't necessarily superfoods just for a diet and health standpoint, but specifically to get your brain working well, to make sure you've got a sharp memory, that you have good retention, all those things. So brain foods are called that because they promote brain function, either by increasing connectivity between the neurons, or increasing blood flow, or preventing the loss of cell function and life. So in Andy's list of 10 foods, there's basically three reasons that they're on the list. That's either omega-3s, which is a fatty acid that we cannot make as humans. We have to eat it. So omega-3s, antioxidants, so pass the wine, pass the chocolate, but sadly wine's not on the list, but there are antioxidants in it. And B vitamins, which are good for memory and metabolizing protein. And there's tons of different B vitamins. So those three, omega-3, antioxidant, B vitamins. And basically every food on the list is rich in one or more of those vitamins. So thinking just about the omega-3s and the antioxidants, first the omega-3s, he lists fatty fish. This is stuff like salmon, albacore tuna, mackerel, and sardines. Walnuts, and flax seeds. There was a surprise on the list to me, and that was red meat for omega-3s. Yeah,
that surprised me too.
Yeah, so that typically has such a bad rep for what it can do to your health. But I think if you, Andy mentions, you know, don't have it a lot, have it once a week, and if you have a big concert coming up, have it maybe a few days before so that you get the most out of those vitamins. When it comes to the antioxidants, of course, just in general, the more food, the more color any food has naturally, the better it is for you, which is just a good blanket rule. But specifically for brain power and retention and preventing memory slips, you can eat celery, so kind of a cousin of rhubarb, which reduces inflammation in the brain and prevents degeneration. You can eat broccoli and cauliflower, which both boost your learning power. Or as I called them when I was young, they were green trees and snow trees, broccoli and cauliflower.
Cute.
You can have blueberries, which rid you of free radicals and reduce degenerative issues. And then some dark chocolate. Thank you very much, which helps to boost blood flow in the brain. Two others, and then I'm going to shoot it back to Casey because I think we've got a crying baby on our hands in the other room, is turmeric, which boosts cell growth and helps your memory. So that's in lots of yummy things like curry. It's what kind of gives it that yellow color, but you can put it in tea and in all kinds of different things. Andy has some suggestions about that. Turmeric also counteracts stress, which is so important because stress hurts and anything and everything we try to do. And lastly on the list is coffee.
That's so good.
And it's a known stimulant, and in appropriate amounts can quicken the excitatory brain chemicals, which keep everything working well.
Well, isn't Andy known for taking caffeine before he performs?
Oh, I don't know.
You guys talk about that?
I don't know.
We might have.
Colin, I think, learned that in his research when he interviewed practice habits and whatnot.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Andy takes a little bit of caffeine.
Oh, he's juicing. He should be stricken from the record books. That's way good news though, that coffee is good for you again.
Yes.
I feel like every month or so it alternates. It's like, no, it's caffeine's terrible for you, and then no, it's good for you again, and yeah. No, but nice article, Andy. And thanks, Laurel. She's grabbing a baby, it looks like. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, another great plug for Percussive Notes, as we probably could do more on this show for sure.
I want to ask, did any of you guys consider your food intake in relationship to your performance?
Yes.
How so?
Yeah, so it has been very consistent for me for many years. What I eat the day before really matters.
Okay.
Like I feel like sugar the day of doesn't matter, but sugar the days leading up to a performance, given that I have to play something that's really physically taxing.
Okay.
it will just be harder to play. And it feels like it's related to a sugar crash. Yeah, it messes with my sleep that way too. Like you have that sugar crash the next day at like 4 p.m. And I go to bed fine, but it's harder to wake up.
Yeah.
So like it's okay. It's just it just doesn't feel good, which I think really matters when you're performing. What about you?
No, not really. That's why I'm just curious. Like I'm interested in what, you know, the things that Laurel shared and Andy was sharing, but I'm trying to figure out like how. It's hard to test some of those things, especially as it relates to maybe the brain function, the brain foods, because there's so many factors in a given day. It's hard to like keep all of the factors the same and then eat different foods and see how it, you know, and have the same performance experience as well. And like, you know, it's hard to kind of really compare. And so I'm just curious about your guys' experience or what has helped or worked for you.
Right. For me, like I run and bike. And I keep very good track of my diet. I kind of take it to the extreme maybe because I weigh and log every single thing that I eat. So that's not so much related to like music and performance. It's just general lifestyle. But
easier for you to keep track.
Yeah. But one thing that blows my mind is like, I don't like people that smoke, like the constant like nicotine high and like, you know, up and down. To go into like a high pressure performance, if you're like you have to smoke beforehand, basically. But then, you know, that has its own inherent problems. So, yeah, that's the one that blows my mind.
But you look cool. That makes so you cool. Feel good.
I remember at PASIC like 2 or 3 years ago, I saw, maybe it's even longer than that, I saw Casey and Pius outside smoking cigarettes. I was like,
we can't say that on air.
Oh, but I just did. And if
my dad's going to lecture me.
Casey, I'm pretty sure you're over 18. It's legal now.
That doesn't mean I'll never be too old to get a lecture, though. That's for sure.
But Pius doesn't smoke anymore.
They quit.
And you don't
smoke
either.
Yeah, they quit.
Yeah except when they're at PASIC trying to be cool.
Trying to be cool. Yeah, I know. You actually weigh your meals?
Yeah, so every single thing I eat, I have a food scale and I weigh it.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of different. And like,
you don't have your scale.
So, well, I use an app called MyFitnessPal. And so, like, if I eat out, especially at like...
He says as he pulls his arm up with his bicep. I know,
just scratching my back.
He's just like casually showing us his bicep. He's like, well, I have this scale.
Oh my God, stop. So, but if you eat out at like a restaurant, like a chain restaurant... Like they all have their nutrition information in there. So yeah, it's like super easy. If you go to Chili's and get the whatever burger, like you can easily log it, which is not health food. But then it does get difficult when you travel. So I kind of guesstimate when I travel, or like I went to like a Thai place a couple days ago and got pad Thai, and there's like generic pad Thai. So you just like log it just to be consistent. Yeah. But yeah, I've logged every single thing I've eaten since January 1st, 2017.
Wow.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Impressive.
Wow. That's very cool.
You're also very healthy, Ben, because you don't do alcohol or caffeine.
Yeah.
So caffeine's good for you.
That's right.
So maybe I'm
in appropriate amounts.
Back to what Brian said initially that started this tangent, you know, it's I think the red meat is a really good example, and Andy says like you don't need much of this, and it's not to say, oh, I've got a performance, okay, I'm gonna eat like 5 steaks before. It's like, okay, your B2 amount is gonna be over adequate, but you're gonna feel terrible for other reasons associated with red meat, you know.
And on that note, I think the problem with caffeine a lot is it's not so much the caffeine as what the caffeine comes with. For example, if you're drinking soda that has a ton of sugar, or if you're drinking like Starbucks, like drinks that have all sorts of cream and sugar and stuff in them, that's different from just like pure, you know, medical grade, so to speak, caffeine.
Yeah, of course. So, hey, I want to ask Brian something about his blog. And I just was poking around and I found one about percussionist composer post, and this struck me as something to read, of course, because Brian and I are both composers and percussionists, but also it seems to me, and maybe you guys know this or have seen this too, but it seems like once every couple of weeks or so, one of our Facebook friends or colleagues or just percussion associates posts some big declarative profound statement about how they don't care for music by percussionists. Mm-hmm. And they say, in what always comes off in a very, I think, bad tone of like, well, I'm really unique because I prefer music by non-percussionists. Like, yeah, okay, look, first of all, that's not profound at all. That's a very opinion, and a lot of people like to declare that as if it's some big thing. And I've always thought and had to explain to people that my opinion and what I've observed is, okay, the people we look to say, look, how to, the people who taught us how to write for piano were pianists. Beethoven was not only a brilliant composer, but he is a killer pianist. Rachmaninoff, killer pianist. Bach, killer keyboardist. You know, it takes someone who
Bach is an organist.
But harpsichord, clavichord, he played all those things. Yeah, but you know, you see what I'm saying. Like, it seems like the people who, I think it's a very short-sighted and pretty ignorant comment, because history shows that you need the pairing of the two.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, of course there's great music by plenty of non-percussionist composers, but you're going to need people who know the instrument to mm-hmm. teach everyone else how to write for it. I mean, think of like a part to, say, Mio, Creation of the World, the drum set part. It's like, man, great piece of music. That could totally be written in a much more idiomatic way. Like, right. If you've ever seen that drum set part, you know. So anyway, I don't know, Brian, you have this post, and it's really well written, and I think you say a lot of great things. What is your thoughts on that?
I'm reviewing it. It's been a bit since I've thought about this, but I remember I shared this with at a concert last June. I did kind of this duo concert with a local musician, and we also shared a few thoughts, and he spoke about like maybe John Cage or something, and I shared these thoughts, and it was just because I played some of my own music at this concert, and sometimes people kind of wonder about that. But I remember it taking several weeks to write this, because I really wanted to think about it a lot, and also like not just make one of those blanket statements like you were talking about, you know, and not just say, oh, well, this is silly, or this is how it is, you know, but like really think about it. And I was also, I was kind of inspired. I was reading that Cambridge Companion to Percussion, which is awesome. For those of you who haven't maybe read that, totally go check that out. But yeah, I mean, I kind of was wondering, why are so many percussionists composing music? And so I don't have to get into all of it, but I shared a few thoughts of why I think that might be in the post. Just that we're, you know, partly that we're tinkerers. We like to play around with things. We like to explore. We like to, you know, half the time we're required to like, you know, choose instruments for a piece or improvise this or that. And, so it kind of makes sense a lot of times that we end up composing things. And then another thing, you know, Casey, you kind of alluded to, is this idea that like, who else knows this giant world of percussion as well as percussionists? And so, why not some of us write some music for percussion, since we know how it works and we can explore it in a level of detail that maybe composers might not ever think of or know to do. And, you know, it's the flip side of that, where composers think of things that percussionists would never think of because it's so outside of the box of what we normally do with percussion. And then there's people like you, Casey, who kind of get both of them. You know, you know how to write for percussion, but you also have this mind of like, you somehow are able to get outside of that in a way that's like total, like putting a music box on timpani. I don't know, you're probably not the first person in the world that's done that, but like, that's the first I've seen it in a piece, you know? So cool. Stuff like that. That's like, I think it's really important that we have those mixes.
Well, thanks a lot for
sure.
Yeah.
I mean it. Yeah.
It seems like whenever I see these declarations on Facebook, it's part of it is always like, oh, the percussionist composer, they just write something that's so idiomatic and it just fits and that's boring. Mm-hmm. I just like wonder, like, wait, were Beethoven and Mozart like having those conversations with their teachers and colleagues, like, oh, this is lame because it lays well on your instrument. Write something that it's like, no, dude, that's part of the puzzle. Like, that's part of the genius of Beethoven's piano writing, is it fits on the instrument. He knows the instrument. But yet we have these, I don't know, we have all these people like saying it all the time, like, oh, this is lame because it's idiomatic. Yeah. It's like, well, wait a minute. It can totally be lame, but it's not lame. Like, idiomatic is good. Like, you want it to fit the instrument. Well,
yeah, it doesn't. Go ahead, Ben.
I was going to say, I mean, Alejandro Vignal talks about this, and he's, you know, very much a composer, not a percussionist composer. And I know when he wrote Con Variations, he was constantly asking, like, does this work on your instrument? And you can't find that advice out without asking someone that plays that instrument. And Con Variations is very difficult, but it also sits on the instrument pretty well. And if it didn't, I think it would be unplayable.
Dude, Sean Tilburg, former guest, Phoenix Symphony, messaged me just a week ago saying, hey, so we're playing this composer's piece, and he saw one of your things, meaning my things, saying, oh, he's asking me to do this, 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 and this, because he saw your video where you're doing this, 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 and that. And I'd just like to also say, man, many, you know, quote, real composers have asked me tons of stuff about my pieces, asked me questions about, oh, I want to use that, and how did you do this? And I think percussionists out there saying this or of this opinion would be surprised to learn. No, I think a lot of times the real composers they're talking about are doing what Ben said. They're giving much more credit to the composer performers. They know, they're smart enough to know, like, no, dude, those are the guys that like really know the instrument, and you can learn a lot from their music without having to like it, or and a lot of times they do happen to like it. So,
and I think I kind of closed my thought with this article with this idea that like we should be looking for and trying to create great music, whether it's by percussionists, composers or not, you know, and not just kind of have this divide and say that, oh, well, it's not by a percussionist, so it's probably not going to sit well and won't be cool. I said it's not by a percussionist, so it will be true art music, or it is by a percussionist, so it's going to not be art music, or it's going to be really fun and jamming because it's not by some artsy fartsy composer person, you know, or whatever.
You know what?
We shouldn't make those assumptions.
You know what this reminds me of? Have you guys ever seen the old Saturday Night Live sketch with if it's not Scottish, it's crap?
Yes.
No. Yeah. It's like, if it's not by a composer, it's crap.
Right. Yes. Well, I think people genuinely cannot tell if something, like, cannot decide for themselves if it's good or not. Or one of the key ingredients to whether something is good or not is if it is acclaimed, if it has, you know, academic backing, if it, you know, that is really like part of what they think literally makes it good. And they, I don't know. It's like, I think it's not having original opinion or thought, you know. It's like, dude, come on, you just decide if it's good or not, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, I liked that post a lot. Yeah, and your other posts as well. So you also have on your website the Blue Hill podcast.
Yeah.
And what I thought, you know, we try our hardest on this show to make sure people don't listen to other podcasts. So I was thinking, if you could just summarize what you did in all, I think it's five good episodes. I've listened to three of them just in the last couple of days, but it looks like you got five different duo interviews in 2015, like a PASIC, it looks like.
Yeah, so it was leading up to our PASIC presentation. We did a professional development kind of performance slash lecture, and we interviewed these Escape 10 joint venture, who you've had both of them on, Maraca 2, me and Perkins. I think we just got Todd for that, or Doug, I don't remember.
Yeah,
I think
just Todd.
We got one, and then the O Duo. from, I think they're from Great Britain as well. But so, yeah, we just got to talk to them and ask specifically about, you know, their life as a duo and how it began and choosing repertoire and these kinds of things. And like you guys have explored on several interviews, they rarely live in the same place.
Right.
And so how do you handle those kinds of things? And so we shared a lot of our findings at our PASIC presentation, but you can listen to all of those interviews on my website there. And I think Colin might have them on his website as well separately, so you can find them easily.
Was there a big takeaway? I feel like, of course, in doing this podcast, there's lots of little tidbits and cool pieces I hang on to. But I also feel like, you know, these large impressions sink in over the course of, you know, many, many episodes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you feel your big opinion shift. Was there any big takeaway for you from doing like a comprehensive five duo interview?
You know, probably the biggest thing was that you really have to like each other.
Yeah.
To do that, you know, and it was really neat to see the musical and otherwise connections between the duo members in each duo. They all brought, you know, their, I think they were able to express their unique music personalities in that context really well. And they, you know, several of them shared about that, but they all talked about like, man, you just have to, you have to really want to hang out with somebody and really get along. But also musically be able to contribute to something that's better, more than, you know, that's the idea of synergy, of getting greater than the sum of the two parts. And I think each of those demonstrates that well.
Mm-hmm.
This reminds me of one of the most interesting things I've ever heard in this vein. You're talking about you have to like each other. Mm. You guys know the magicians Penn and Teller?
Yeah.
Have you heard about their relationship? It's not that they don't get along, but from what I understand, it's entirely professional. They don't hang out together like when they're not working or anything like that. And again, it's not that they don't like each other. They just prefer to keep it like their professional and personal lives in that sense totally separate, which seems just bizarre because I can't imagine being in a music duo with someone that I wasn't, you know, good friends from school with or hadn't had some sort of good connection with. But that's how Penn and Teller do it, apparently.
Yeah, I've not heard that.
Well, and the Mythbusters supposedly just can't stand each other.
Oh, man.
The original yeah. Mythbusters. Yeah. I wouldn't have guessed that about Penn and Teller, though. I mean, so strictly comedy-driven.
Such a performance.
Yeah, I like that. I like that show a lot. Ben, why don't you hit us up with your topic?
Sure. So I just had a little brief thing to share today. In Dallas, I saw that they were having some special Olympics events, and it made something pop in my head that I knew a long time ago and had never thought about and hadn't shared on the podcast, so I wanted to share it as sort of related to that. Have you guys ever heard of Marimba Village?
No, not until you mentioned it.
So it's in the Rebecca Kite Keiko Abe book, and I couldn't find my copy of the Kite book, so I couldn't remember what she said about it in the book, but I found an article, and I'm mostly going to actually sort of just read some stuff from the article, because this article, it's like, it's difficult to find it. It's archived online, but the original like online posting, so to speak, isn't there anymore. It's from the spring 2007 issue of Traps magazine. It's written by Rebecca Kite, and it's called How to Build a Marimba Village. So basically, from my understanding, in Japan, it's sort of like how the U.S. was maybe 50, 60 years ago. When you have someone with special needs, in particular Down syndrome, it used to be the case that you would sort of send them off to a facility that handled people like that. They weren't generally like welcomed into the family, and you know, it was sort of like considered a shameful thing. And from what I understand, Keiko Abe felt very deeply against this and very much wanted these people to have quality of life and be part of just the community at large. So she, Keiko Abe has a friend named Katsuko Nakamura that purchased a large farm in the rolling hills of the Maruyama Highlands in Kumamoto, which is in the center of Kyushu, which is Japan's most southernmost island. And so her friend Nakamura wanted to, and I'm quoting the article quite heavily now, her purpose was to create an atmosphere and place where the mentally challenged could come to experience a more fulfilling life than in an isolated institution where they had lived before. And so Abe said to Nakamura, "I have a dream to create a marimba village where simple marimbas are placed out in the field and among the trees as if they grow there up from the earth. And the people who happen to walk past these magical instruments might stop and play them. Perhaps someone on the next hillside will hear and be inspired to answer with music. Perhaps the birds will answer, and for a moment, each person will find musical inspiration and a close connection with nature." So I thought it was a very beautiful sort of mission, and the Yamaha Corporation donated the assistance of its engineers. They selected a particular native wood from the island for the bars, and they designed simple instruments, and they had volunteers help to make them. It says, "These rustic marimbas, which had 3 to 8 tone bars, no resonators, and mallets attached by cords, were built in a range of heights, some of which were wheelchair accessible. They were then installed in the surrounding hills, where their sound could be heard from one hill to another, and people might play musical responses to one another." Continuing on reading from the article, it says, "At the Marimba Village opening ceremony, with the governor of Kumamoto and the town council members in attendance, Abe was presented with the title Honorable Mayor of Marimba Village. As Nakamura later described, the rustic marimbas concert that day, played by Special Olympics athletes and volunteers, the 16 instruments installed on the hills created gentle wooden sounds echoing here and there, harmonizing with nature and controlling our minds. Wrote Nabue Tanaka, founder of the Tokyo branch of the Special Olympics and close friend of Abe, "When we came to this spot the first time, we saw the 7 colors of a rainbow stretching over the mountain, the promise of a good start. We arrived in the afternoon that day, and the rainbow remained until sunset." And then continuing on, I have this as a quote. I think this is Keiko Abe saying this. "Now, with this success, everyone can come up to the mountain to farm, to grow flowers, and to play the marimba. It is good for refreshing one's life. The 5 senses are important for a good life, and now we will provide that here for handicapped people." So wow. I thought it was just like a very, very beautiful sort of thing to share. I tried to find more about this online. I tried to find pictures or anything.
I know, I'm like hoping for a picture.
And there was so, and I emailed Rebecca Kite even, and she said she would try to get back to me if she had any pictures, but I never heard anything. I did find that there was a 10-year anniversary concert played there. And so this article is from 2007, so that would have been relatively recently, and that was actually Keiko Abe's marimba ensemble. I'm not sure if she was present or not, but her marimba ensemble played for the 10th anniversary. So I'm led to believe that it's still there, still in use, and I would love to someday make it to Japan and see this sort of beautiful place. But anyway, Special Olympics, I thought I'd kind of share that little tidbit about a nice little thing the percussion community has been able to provide.
That's so cool.
It's really neat.
It's a really neat example of, okay, you know, we're all trying to be performer educators for a living. And once you, okay, you're a successful performer like Keiko Abe, what do you do? Make another CD, do another tour, make yet another CD. It's like, well, maybe you could start doing things like this. You
know, yeah. Other... And I mean, I have a sort of distant relative that had Down syndrome, and he's passed away. He passed away maybe 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. But it was like the same sort of thing. Like his family back in the 40s or 50s, something like that, did not want to send him off. They wanted him to be part of the community, and he liked to go to church, and the church organist would let him play the organ. And it's just, these people deserve quality of life as well.
Wow. Way to go, Ben. That's really cool. Great to know about that. Yeah. It's a shame there's not, you can't find more. There's this one little write up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and maybe by the time this episode is published, Rebecca Kite will have gotten back to you. And if you see any pictures float across your screen right now, you'll know that we got them in time for me to edit them in. But well, we do have a question from Facebook from our friend Josh Jones. He will be on the show in, geez, a couple episodes from now. Laurel booked him just recently. And he asked Brian, what was your biggest hurdle and what got you?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
it's hard to say what a biggest one is. I guess I could talk about, you know, failed auditions. Probably, you know, I told you how important like the marching thing was to me when I was growing up, and marching band was like everything at my school. And when I started learning about drum corps, I thought, I have to do this. And so I thought, and I was like, I told you, I was like tiny school in rural Indiana. And I was like, I thought I was super awesome. And so I went to a drum corps camp and I just got really put in my place. And it was, there was like one spot on snare. This was at Glassman 2002. And yeah, I was like, you know, one of 89 or 90 some kids that got cut. And I was at the bottom of that list. And it was like, whew, man. I realized I had a lot to overcome. And it was pretty crushing because I walked in there thinking I was going to get a spot. Because I had some people tell me like, oh, yeah, you know, you're really good and you'll probably get in. And these were not percussion people. These were other people in the pageantry arts or guard people that just thought they didn't know anything about my actual ability as it compared to what it took to get in. And so it was pretty crushing. And I thought, man, maybe I'm not supposed to do this drum corps thing. But eventually, you know, you get over it. And my dad was a band director. He started asking his band director friends, you know, anybody that like has connections with the drum corps, like has taught drum corps that could help teach my son. And I eventually got connected with a guy named Brent Montgomery. And I drove like an hour and a half, you know, to take lessons with him. And he had taught a lot of drum corps. He taught at Star of Indiana, taught it, several different places and including Glassman. And so anyway, he taught me how to play a drum basically over the next several months. And I auditioned again the next year and got in and, changed my life, you know, the whole drum corps thing.
Yeah. Wow.
Cool. That's one thing I guess comes to mind.
Well, when we were wrapping up in Florida, I saw a book on your piano called Peak, and it sparked my interest because we've talked about one of the authors on the show many, many episodes ago, Anders Ericsson, and you said, oh yeah, it's one of my favorite books, and here, take it, and you gave it to me, and I thought, oh, there's a great joke there, like, I just finished my recital, and Brian's like, hey, you really could use this book.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
I know, right? Yeah, he's playing it off like he really cares, really. He's just giving me...
Yeah, I hadn't even read it yet. I was just like, you need to read this.
Yeah, I'm sure you need to read this. Anything would be good. Just do anything else. Anything would be good. Yeah. So, but yeah, that book is kind of about, like, you know, the 10,000 hour rule and what was the subtitle? Peak, the secrets from the new science of expertise. So,
Anders Ericsson, it's funny because it's like secrets. We're going to put it in a book.
I know.
It's not really a secret.
I know. But you had mentioned that you bought several copies of this because you just like what it has to say, and you give the copies to students and just really believe in what's in there.
Totally. And one of the things I need to mention I recommend anyone who wants to read it. It's just kind of about his research over 30 plus years of like what it takes to be an expert at anything. One of the things I definitely wanted to mention was there's a whole chapter, or at least a section, regarding that 10,000 hour rule, which he never coined. That was a Malcolm Gladwell thing in his book Outliers.
Yeah.
And he essentially kind of fights back a little bit at that to say like, look, this, I never said that. And my research doesn't say that if you spend 10,000 hours, you'll be an expert.
Yeah.
And Gladwell kind of made it sound like that a little bit. I think he took Ericsson's research and spun it a certain way. And Ericsson respectfully said, no, that's not really what I said. Here's what I mean. So I mentioned that to say, because I know a lot of people, that 10,000 hour rule thing goes around. And I would have some questions with that sometimes. And so it was good to read Ericsson's response to that in this book. That made me feel a little bit better about not fully 100% buying into that idea. There's certainly something to it, you know, based on some research, but it's exactly what maybe Gladwell made it out to be. So,
and I'm not sure. I'm not sure the episode that I reported it on, but that was basically what I was doing, is debunking the 10,000-hour rule. And
yeah,
basically discovering that, oh yeah, Malcolm Gladwell just kind of boiled this down to a little catchphrase.
Exactly.
It's pretty, yeah, inaccurate as far as what all the research has to say.
Yeah, but I've always been interested in the psychology aspect of music, and of course I know Laurel, you definitely have, you know, shared a lot of things about that, so I just love those segments. But it's very interesting and pretty convincing, the stuff that Erickson shares throughout the book. And it takes like 100 pages for him to finally lay out, here's what deliberate practice really is. I'm like, just get to the point. Like,
right.
But finally, you know, he does. And of course you can read his original published research on deliberate practice from like, it's like in the 90s or something, but that's available online too. But anyway, I definitely am fascinated by that whole thing. And for myself and how it affects how I teach my students and the types of things that I want them to be thinking about, and how to practice and all of that. It's just so important, and it's such a waste of time if you're not practicing well. And if you don't have much time, you know, then you certainly don't have any time to waste.
Yeah. I started reading it. I haven't gotten super far yet, but I actually started reading it on the plane home, and somewhere early on, he compares compares whatever you're trying to do to trying to learn tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And if you decide, okay, I'm going to learn tennis and I'm going to take a few lessons, I'm going to practice a bunch, and I'm just going to get to where I'm not ashamed to play with my friends. That's my only goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to take, you know, not that long. You can do that, and it will take some time, but it won't take that long. And eventually you're going to hit a wall. You know, there's going to be a certain serve that you just can't return. And there's going to be a certain backhand that you're going to have to do deliberate practice to get better at. You're not going to overcome those challenges just by continuing to play casually with your friends. And it's this great comparison, this great analogy, and I think it's really, really easy to follow. And I have read some of the original publication, and I would suggest to a student, read Peak. I think read
definitely.
The book. It's like easier, and it's more fun.
A greater volume of his work as well, and kind of it puts together everything in one place. And another big major takeaway that I've continued to chew on almost every day from that book was this idea of mental representations, mental maps, and how important that is in developing expertise in any field. But that understanding of like, what's the goal, you know, what does it actually look like to be really good at this, and then figuring out how to get there. And it doesn't, one way to not get there is to practice the things you're good at, right? Like you're just talking about, like, right. That bat, you're no good at the backhand, and it's always pinpointing and isolating the things that you stink at, that you have to really work at, and building this bigger map. You know, I kind of liken it to you're looking at like a map of Europe, and you see Paris and Munich and Rome, and like that's about it, and this sort of vague outline. And then when you're first starting something, that's kind of your mental map of music or percussion, and then you start adding in these different cities, and then you start putting all the connections between them and figuring out all these roads. And if this road doesn't work, here's another way to get there. And this much more detailed map of like what it means to be a musician or a percussionist, how to get there, what it should sound like when it's good in this style of music or that style of music or this instrument or that instrument. Like, these are so important. And it's easy for me to think that my students know these things, or like that their map looks the same as my map. But like, they might just have these two points on it and they don't know any of the roads between them.
Right.
Or maybe they don't even have the second point on the map. That I'm just like, just follow the map, just go from here to there. And they're like, okay. But then, you know, I forget that their map looks different from my map. Like their understanding of things looks different.
That's a good analogy for us, because I think I do that too. Like, you don't know what they don't know, you know?
Right.
Yeah. I back to the tennis analogy real quick. He builds this great analogy of like, okay, you decide you want to play tennis and you're going to hit a wall, and then you're going to have to change your practice if you want to beat that wall, etc. A problem I find, and maybe he addresses this later in the book or somewhere else in the research, is sometimes people haven't even decided that they really want to play tennis yet.
Oh, man.
You know, like, it's like, okay, at least you decided you want to play tennis and be this good. At least you decided you want to go from zero to casual. But sometimes you're fighting with someone about trying to get them to practice and try to motivate them, and I'm still wondering, like, wait, I'm not even sure you've decided you want to do this yet. You know, like, that's the thing they're wrestling with. They're not wrestling with like, oh, I'm just I can't find time, or I don't know how to practice. It's just like, I don't know if you know you actually are actually interested in this or not, you know.
That's, I think, that's probably a different topic. He addresses motivation to a degree, and how important that is. But I'm totally with you. There's those students sometimes where I just like, I realize I'm pushing that. And then you take a second and think, maybe you just don't. Yeah. You haven't even decided that you want to do this. So everything I'm saying isn't going to help, you know?
Right. Yeah.
That's a good point.
Very cool. Well, I'm sure, man, we could talk a lot about
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. Hey, well, you guys, thanks so much. This was 146. Thanks so much, Laurel and Ben, of course, and Brian Bloom. It's good to see you again, buddy.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It was really fun.
Cool, cool. Okay, guys, thanks. We'll catch you on 147.
All right.
Cool.